From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Why do some men assault their wives and think that's acceptable behavior? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with two men who counsel abusive men. Rob Carter works with men from diverse backgrounds in Philadelphia. Psychologist Donald Dutton founded a counseling program for abusive husbands in Vancouver. In the O.J. Simpson pretrial, Dutton was an expert witness for the prosecution. His new book presents a psychological profile of the batterer. A look at domestic violence coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. An express commuter train crashed into a school bus at a Chicago suburban train crossing today, killing five people and injuring another 30. The bus was torn apart while stunned witnesses watched. Some of the critically injured people have been taken to six hospitals, some up to 30 miles away. A spokesman for the Metro commuter train says the train was going about 50 miles per hour, slower than the speed limit, and the engineer was trying to brake, but he was unable to stop in time. In Houston, the jury that convicted Yolanda Saldivar of murdering Tejano singer Selena is now considering her punishment. Jim Bell of member station KUHF reports.
In a surprise move this morning, prosecutors decided against using old, unproven embezzlement allegations against Saldivar during the punishment phase of her trial. After presenting just one witness today, the state rested its case. Defense attorneys then brought in members of Saldivar's family, who testified that she is a loving and caring person who should not be sent to prison. The most dramatic testimony was from Saldivar's elderly father, who tearfully pleaded with the jury to let him take his baby girl home. In final arguments, the defense said there's nothing society can gain by sending Saldivar to prison, and they asked for supervised probation. Prosecutors said Saldivar took away Selena's life and must now pay for that with life in prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Bell in Houston.
Some 400 people in Central California are starting to go home after a toxic chemical spill. The accident came after a train car derailed with 30 others overnight in Shafter, California. No one was seriously injured. The White House today said the president will not veto a bill passed by Congress yesterday, which would move the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. PLO leader Yasser Arafat responded to the congressional action by calling for a united Jerusalem that would be capital to both Israelis and Palestinians. Arafat made his comments during a speech at Harvard University's Kennedy School last night. Tovia Smith of member station WBUR reports.
Arafat greeted a mostly supportive crowd at Harvard in Hebrew and Arabic and then spoke of his commitment to peace, saying the process was irreversible. He criticized what he called fanatics on both the Palestinian and Israeli sides, and he said Jews and Arabs must live together, even sharing the same capital of Jerusalem.
Why not to have, okay, Jerusalem is a capital for two states without the Berlin Wall? United, open.
Harvard has been using a grant given by an American Jew to offer technical assistance to the new Palestinian National Authority. A handful of protesters showed up at the school to deride the Jewish donor as a turncoat and to denounce Arafat as a murderer. For National Public Radio, this is Tovia Smith in Cambridge.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 42 points. This is NPR. A consumer group says fake fat is not fit for human consumption. The Center for Science in the Public Interest says the fat substitute called Olestra is too dangerous to be used as a food additive. CSPI says the Food and Drug Administration shouldn't approve it because Olestra causes unpleasant gastrointestinal symptoms. It also says the combination of sugar and vegetable oil hurts people because it drives cancer-fighting nutrients out of the body. Procter & Gamble has been developing Olestra. The firm says it's been well-tested and is safe to use in such foods like potato chips. The UN peacekeeping force in Bosnia has opened a road from Sarajevo to the eastern enclave of Garajda. Officials are now regularly sending aid convoys into Garajda. NPR's Mike Schuster went along on one of the trips.
Garajda has been cut off from the outside world for more than 3 years. It is a town of more than 50,000 people, most of them Muslims. The Bosnian Serb army has been continuously shelling Garajda from hills that encircle the town. The last shell fell about 3 weeks ago. Hundreds of children swarm the streets here. Most of the food is brought now by the UN. Hardly a building or home has not been damaged by the shelling. Most are in rubble. But the people of Garajda have been working to keep their town from collapsing. Men are cutting wood everywhere, the only fuel for the coming winter. The streets are clear of rubble, and although some did die from hunger during the siege, most people on the streets appear healthy. But Garajda has no electricity, gas, or running water, and Garajda's inhabitants still do not know what their ultimate fate will be. I'm Mike Schuster in Garajda.
A private realtors group says sales of existing homes rose 0.7% last month. The National Association of Realtors says home buyers have been spurred on by low interest rates. The September sales rate is the highest monthly record since January 1994. All regions of the country saw an increase, and the realtors say the jump in home resales shows the housing industry is strong. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many men who beat their wives don't admit they're doing anything wrong. What's it like to try to get through to them? We asked Rob Carter. He runs group counseling sessions for abusive men through the Philadelphia-based group Project RAP, which is part of Family Service of Philadelphia. The men he sees have been referred by family court, women's shelters, mental health centers, and alcohol rehabilitation clinics, or they have sought out help on their own. Each group is racially mixed, and the men range from rich to poor. Carter also works with teenage and preteen boys trying to prevent violent behavior through a program called Peaceful Posse. I asked him if the abusive men he counsels often try to justify their violent behavior by saying, she asked for it.
Yes, do hear that a lot, that she asked for it. And one guy who came in the office yesterday, his way of saying she asked for it is he stated that he couldn't stand the pressure. I can't stand the pressure. And what he meant by the pressure was his perception that he was being nagged or being asked things over and over again and him not appreciating it. And in a sense saying, because my partner does this, I'm allowed to do whatever I can because I can't stand it. And I was very upfront with him because he was... He said he appreciates people talking to him. And I said, I believe the work is going to be for you to be able to be much more tolerant of others, and particularly your partner, and understanding what does pressure mean to you. And if you can't stand the pressure, what you're saying is that you'll hit her. So he says it just slips out, and it is his hand, it's his fist. So he talked about this one occasion where he wanted to go out and his partner didn't want him to go out, and they got into an argument, and he said it just slipped out. And I asked him what it was. I asked him to be real specific, and it was him reaching over with his fist and hitting his partner in her stomach. And there were other things he failed to bring out initially, which we later found out was, which he later told me after I asked him, was that his partner was pregnant.
Oh, boy. When you started doing this work, were you shocked at the stories that you heard?
Some of them, I was shocked at some of the stories, but on the feeling level, I could, growing up male in this society, I can relate to a lot of the guys in terms of how they feel, and that's oftentimes why I use the word we. But some of the stories I was very, very shocked of. I mean, shocked of a story where one of the guys I work with, an intelligent guy, what he did was he tapped the phones. He did phone tap on his partner without her knowledge, and he would just listen to the tapes that he had made of her conversations, and it would really rev him up in a frenzy. And what he did after hearing some of the telephone conversations, after re-listening to some of her telephone conversations, he really brutalized his partner. He raped her. He beat her up pretty bad. I'm just remembering it right now. But I think it's important to for me to maintain a balance and to be with the guys and not to be too, like, blown away by what they say, but also to be able to reflect that I am impacted upon by hearing some of these stories. I'm not a wall of stone. I mean, these stories do affect me, and I do openly say, wow, wow, that really saddens me, or I'm really scared when I hear that.
In your groups, when men describe their behavior, when you talk with them about what they've done, do they often think that they haven't done anything wrong?
Yes. Sometimes they think they haven't done anything wrong, and sometimes it's the power of the group that assists a man in being able to take a look at what he's presenting and what he puts out. For example, oftentimes guys will connect with other guys' stories and they'll see themselves in another man. They'll be able to get something that maybe you as an individual therapist, may have been trying to work on them with. But when they hear it from a guy in the group, from one of their brothers, from one of their partners in the group, they're able to see it. The group work is so powerful. It's so powerful. And in order to set the stage for the group to be powerful, we have to be accepting of hearing some of these horror stories. And if we are not accepting of hearing the horror stories, then a lot of the work can't get done.
Tell us what a typical group session is like.
Typical group session is about 2 hours in length. You have guys from all, you know, walks of life. You may have guys who own their own business, to guys who are unemployed, guys who are white, guys who are black, guys who are Latino, one Asian guy in the group. I'm thinking of a group that we do in the evening at RAP and also at Menergy. A typical group will begin with a check-in where guys will report whether there's been any physical abuse, whether he's been abusive physically or emotionally or verbally or sexually, and or has exhibited any controlling behavior. That's really important because controlling behavior a lot of times is at the root. You know, many of the guys who come to the program are very kind of controlling guys. Talking about the feelings, highs and lows for the week. And it's amazing how many of the guys who are in the group are unaware of just things that affect them throughout the week. A guy might want to check in and say, no highs, no nothing particularly happened to me this week. And we'll challenge a guy and try to ask him to say, hey, well, if you were alive this week, then there's something that happened within your life that you may have felt particularly good about or something that you felt particularly low about. And we believe that working with our feelings is one of the cornerstones of the work to help a guy become identified, attached with how I'm feeling, how I'm doing.
For some of the men in your group, is the group the first time that they've heard what you're doing, hitting your wife or your girlfriend, is morally wrong and it's unacceptable behavior? I don't care what she did, what perceived injustice this is, you cannot do this, this is wrong. Have they often not heard that before? Do they often think it's okay? It's okay to do this. It's acceptable.
I can answer that by giving you a good example. A guy in a group who talked about how his father would tell him, you know, you don't hit girls, you don't hit girls, you don't hit girls. But his father would hit his mother, okay? And his father would hit him. So he would hear, it's wrong. He would hear, you don't hit. But what he was learning, what he was feeling, what he was experiencing was being hit and watching him hit, watching his father hit his mother. So on some level, I think many of the guys know, hey, this is not cool. I shouldn't be doing this. But on a deeper level, if they feel threatened, feeling attacked, feeling shamed, feeling embarrassed. Some of us kind of go back to what we've learned or what we've felt and what we've experienced. The one thing that I've noticed with some really young guys, because I've have been very fortunate to work with some teenage guys, some guys do have groups that support negative behavior. Like, I was on the L the other day, and these two guys were sitting on the L talking. They couldn't have been more than 15, 16 years old, talking about how one guy was talking to the other guy how he had to smack his girlfriend. He had to hit her. And the other guy said, yeah, well, man, you just have to do what you have to do. So on some level, you may have a group of guys or a circle of friends that may support that really negative and abusive behavior. But deep down, hopefully this guy's, he knows, you know, it's not the right thing to do.
My guest is Rob Carter. He counsels abusive men in Philadelphia through the program Project Rap. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rob Carter. He counsels abusive men. How often do you feel that you see men change?
Pretty quickly, many of the men who come in the program, who come into either rap or come into either Menergy in Philadelphia, will change their physical abusive behavior. Many of the guys, when I see an individual treatment first, I'll ask them to give me their word. And it may, you know, what I'll do is I'll ask them, I kind of lead them into it. I say, you know, after we talk a whole lot about the abuse and a whole lot about why they're there, and to the end of the session, I'll say, well, is there anything in particular that you feel good about? You feel that you've accomplished? And they'll tell me that, you know, maybe graduate high school or play sports. I say, well, what did you need to accomplish it? Well, I needed perseverance, and I needed to not give up. I needed to, study. I needed to read. I needed to try to be a better person. And I'll extend my hand and I'll say, well, you'll need all those qualities in order for you to be in this program, in order for you to be abuse-free. You have to commit yourself to being different, because if you want to stop hitting, you have to be different. Now, what research has said is that many of the guys who stop being physically abusive, the emotional abuse and the verbal abuse usually increases. You got to put the guy's hand behind his back, and then, you know, he still hasn't changed. I mean, he still's got a lot of this inner stuff going on. So, you know, you got to deal with that. So when you say change, you say, okay, at least, you know, morally, I have to deal with, hey, you can't hit. That is wrong. And you have to deal with that first. And then the real work starts. I'm not saying that isn't real work, the physical stuff, because it is, but.
Tell me how you deal with this, if in fact this comes up. Some people say, you know, you have to understand things are different in the African-American community.
Right.
Because America is so racist, and because black men are so often the victims of racism, that it's hard for them to maintain their self-respect sometime. And it becomes more important for them to have a sense of authority and respect when they get home. And because there's all these pressures on them, they sometimes pass the pressures on. If they're feeling like they're mentally abused or the victims of racism, they're going to pass that on, sometimes in the form of abuse to their wife. I mean, this isn't my opinion. This is what I often hear said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that because of racism, it's more important for men to have that sense of authority within the family. Do you hear that much from men you work with or from people outside of the therapeutic world? And if so, how do you deal with that?
Well, it's really interesting because you got in a sense, when you talk about the black experience, where oftentimes we as black men, black people too, have experienced being underfoot, being not appreciated, going back to being disrespected, being denied, and having no way of talking, of releasing, of dealing with this, and then going home. And you have a very wounded person going home in a situation where the person feels very underfoot. okay, you've got a very dangerous person. You've got a very dangerous person. And then on the other side of the spectrum, let's say you have a person that is being the initiator of that. Someone, for example, I'm thinking of a guy really specifically in the business world who's very dominant, who's very abusive, who is the perpetrator, who's putting a lot of pressure on his subordinates, so to speak, who's all day screaming and hollering and ordering people around. This person's not going to come home and be different. He's not going to come home. So you got those two guys in a group together.
Is there a specific example you could give us of how the person who's the abusive boss has interacted in your group with the person who's the kind of subordinate in that situation, and they both go home and beat their wives?
Yeah. Got a guy who's in one of the groups who's been very successful financially. I mean, very successful, has his own business, has been working for years. He's a very aggressive man, has a lot of people under him who he orders around, and he's been very abusive to. He's been very abusive to people in the work setting. Talking about a person who's, I think at his young age, his father was very abusive to him also. He was in the service. So he's got a lot of things to kind of add to. He's somebody who was not nurtured a whole lot growing up, not cared for in an emotional sense, a lot of longing for his father, who was very controlling, abusive, and didn't really have time or want to spend a whole lot of time with him. Okay. But this kid grows up, becomes very successful financially, very dictator-like. He's in a group with a guy who very poor, okay, unemployed, hasn't gotten a whole lot of opportunities, going to try to finish up on his GED, and they're both in the same group, and both of them have been physically abusive to their partner. And what I found out is when they've shared their stories, particularly both of these guys shared their stories about their fathers. Now, the one guy who studying for his GED, has been very, very abused as a child, his father pulled a gun on him when he was a teenager. And pulled a gun on him, told him he brought him in this world and he would take him out of this world if he had to. And this gentleman was sharing his story and was upset, really upset about that. Another gentleman who's pretty successful was listening to his story, and he was able to share with him, he connected with him about how abusive his father was to him. His father never pulled a gun on him, but his father beat him really, really severely. And they were able to come together.
Now, I know you went to the Million Man March, and I'm wondering if your participation in that march had anything to do with, and what you wanted from the march, had anything to do with the work that you do with men who are abusers. And I ask that knowing that part of the mission of the march was a sense of personal atonement, personal responsibility, and atonement in part for the way some men treat the women in their lives. Mm-hmm. And that's what the therapy you do is about.
Yeah, that's the work. That's what the work is all about. The Million Man March was a very miraculous experience for me. I mean, entering the mall and just seeing all those men and the atmosphere was so peaceful. I've never heard so many excuse me, please, thank you, my fault, brother. It was amazing. I was emotionally fooled up by the whole experience, just creating an atmosphere of peace. And I think that's very much connected to the mission at where I work, just creating and being able to have an environment where guys can talk about some the violent things, the abusive things they've done. But the work is to be at peace with yourself. The work is to be non-abusive. One of the things that was very important for me was to for us, for black men to look at each other without hostility, without that sense of ill regard, without that sense of threat, without that sense of fear. Because I think oftentimes when you see a group of black men, you even as a black man, you have some kind of concerns. You have concerns. I mean, I've grown up in America too, so I it's not just white males or white people who have fear. I think we have fear of each other sometimes, and we see the images that are portrayed of us on TV and in the movies and in the newspapers. So to have such a massive experience where all of those things didn't materialize, those kind of, I mean, a guy, people were laying camcorders on the ground. People had bags on the ground, and they would just leave and they'd come back and they would be there. That kind of trust was all around. So I thought that was important. That was important to help me to kind of go home and get enough energy to still be about this work, because it isn't always easy to do the work. I mean, some of the stories are very difficult to hear, you know, very, you know, hard to kind of stay with. And I have to debrief myself and talk with someone to get some of it off me. And I had just a strong sense of gratitude for just being there, for being able to make it to the march.
Rub Carter is a clinical social worker with Project RAP, the Reduce Abuse Program of the Family Service of Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a psychological profile of abusive men. We talk with psychologist Donald Dutton, who directs the Assault of Husbands program in Vancouver. He was an expert witness for the prosecution during the O.J. Simpson pretrial.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After about 20 years of counseling men who batter women, psychologist Donald Dutton has tried to answer the question, what made them that way? Dutton presents a psychological profile of the abusive man in his new book, The Batterer. Dutton directs the Assaultive Husbands Program in Vancouver. He testified in the O.J. Simpson pretrial hearing and was the prosecution's sole domestic violence expert to take the stand in the Simpson case. Dutton is particularly interested in what he calls the cyclical batterer, the man who alternates between periods of tension, abuse, and contrition. He says that women often assume that the contrition phase, in which the man is attentive and apologetic, represents his real personality, and that's one reason why women often stay.
When this happens the first time, what this woman has seen by and large has been the good guy. That's been the one who's wooed her, who's courted her. When the violence erupts the first time, it generally comes out of the blue, and it's really a shock. It doesn't fit in with the rest of what she knows about this man. And so it does seem like an aberration. And then when he goes back to being the good guy again, she begins to believe that that was just some kind of passing aberration and it's not going to happen again. And these men can be very convincing at this particular point in terms of their proclamations about changing, and some of them are genuinely sorry that it happened. It's just that they don't really know how to change it. And I mean, my advice to a woman who has this happen to her would be to insist at the very beginning of the relationship that this man get help right away, that she doesn't want this to happen again, and to make sure that he both takes initiative for getting help, by which I mean group treatment is probably the best thing, and that he doesn't backslide from the treatment. He completes it, in other words.
Do you think it's a mistake to assume that the nicer cycle, the contrition cycle, is the real personality and that the violent part is the aberration, the part that isn't the real man?
They're both real. I mean, I can't tell you how many women have come in and described their husband as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. These are both real aspects of this man's personality. They have origins very early in this man's development, probably before the age of 2, in fact, which is kind of shocking to some people.
Are most of the men who you see referred by the criminal justice system?
The bulk of them, about 80 to 90%, come through the courts, yes. They've been convicted in court of wife assault.
So that means they don't necessarily feel that they need to change. They've been told they need to change, but that feeling's not coming from within.
Yeah, that's right, and that's a major problem working with court-mandated men, is that you have to spend a lot of time in the beginning getting this man to realize that there's costs attached to his abusiveness. Now, most men who come through the courts have been violent more than once. I mean, it's rare to actually get somebody who comes in on a first assault, and sometimes that happens, but more typically, there's been a history of assault, and it's just finally got to the point where it reached police attention. And so one of the things you want to do is to do a really thorough assessment with the man's female partner to find out how much violence is there. You need this man to see what the costs and consequences of his violence are on his partner. You also need him to see what the costs and consequences of his violence are on any children he might have and on himself, because people who are consistently approaching the world with that kind of high level of irritability and anger are creating a kind of corticosteroid pool for themselves that's really not very healthy, and it's got negative health costs. So you spend a lot of time just sort of showing them that there's a lot of costs attached to their anger, and you have to sort of sell them on the idea that the treatment is worthwhile for them.
What are some of the justifications you've heard men make for beating up their wives?
She nagged me too much. She does. I keep telling her not to do drugs, and she does drugs. The house is a mess all the time. I come home, I work 10 hours a day. She's got nothing to do here. I come back, and the place is a pigsty. She doesn't look after the kids properly. Those are the main ones.
And they think it's okay to beat their wives because of that behavior?
Well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, most men don't actually think that what they do is okay. They'll say, I realize I shouldn't have done that. It was the wrong thing to do. I lost it, or I lost my temper. I mean, they'll find some way to make it sound like they lost control of the situation, but they don't actually view the actions that they took as being acceptable. I mean, there's some exceptions to that, but I would say 95% of men who come in for their initial assessment don't feel that what they did was all right.
This is often the man's first time in therapy.
Yeah, most of them. The only exception to that is if some of these men have been to AA meetings. That's the only exception. Apart from that, it's their first experience with therapy, so they've got all kinds of male dread about having to talk about their feelings in front of other men, and that's why the opening night is really, when you walk into the group on opening night, you can cut the air with a knife practically. It's so tense in there. It's only after everybody's told their story that you begin to get this process of bonding that starts to go on and people begin to relax a little bit.
Tell us what an opening night is like.
You walk into the room, there's supposed to be 12 clients there. At least 4 of them will be late because it's first night and they can't find the place, so the other 8 will be tremendously uptight. And you'll get a clear example of how they deal with their anxiety. Some of them will be sitting there staring straight down at the floor. Others will be pacing around. Others will be outside smoking cigarettes and trying to calm their nerves. I've had everything from men on opening night challenge my co-therapist's credentials and say, "You're psychoanalyzing me," and then bolt out of the room, to men taking on other men in the group on opening night, just because they convert the anxiety into anger, and driving the other men out of the room, to men breaking down in tears over what they did. So, I mean, the one thing I think you could say to describe what goes on, and there's a high level of emotion in there on opening night.
During this opening night, when men are telling their stories, and you hear something that's really horrifying, what do you say?
We asked them. We would first of all ask the man how he felt about that, he himself. And then we would probably ask the other men in the room how they felt about it. And you get a mixture of things. I mean, you will get men saying, "Boy, I thought I had a problem with violence, boy, until I heard what this guy said." And then you have to work on that, because you have to also confront this man on the fact that he can sort of dodge his own issues by pointing to someone he sees as being worse off as a way of not working on his own issues, okay? But with the horrifying stuff, I think the opening night, you basically, all you want to do is hear how people feel about it, including the transgressor himself. Now, maybe 3 or 4 weeks down the line, when you've been working with these men a little bit more, see, what you're trying to do is this. Rather than globally shame the man about what he's done, what you want to really keep focusing on is how he can change those specific behaviors. And again, I have to reiterate that most of these men find these behaviors unacceptable themselves. And so you have to keep going back to that. What we sometimes ask men to do, in fact, we frequently ask them to do that, is to write a personal violence policy. That is, we ask them, under what circumstances in your life do you think it's okay to use violence? And they have to come in with it. They have to think about it all week and bring in a written statement the next week. Now, most men will say things like, "If I felt someone was attacking my family, I think it would be okay to use violence to defend my family." Or, "If someone was attacking me, I think it would be okay to use violence in self-defense." And so then what we've got from them at that point is their own statement of their own values and their own policy. And in all the weeks that follow after that, we'll keep going back to that. So if they do something that doesn't fit their own policy, we'll keep pointing out the differences to them between their own actions and what they say their policy is. And we get them to commit to the fact that this is what they want their policy to be. And I think that's important, because this way it's coming more from the man rather than something that's imposed from outside by the therapist.
How honest are men, though, when they fill out that personal policy?
Well, we spend a lot of time asking them about it. We go over every aspect of it, and we say, "Well, you're sure now this? Well, what about if this happened? And do you think it's okay to use violence if you're really feeling cornered and your wife is winning an argument?" And I mean, all we can do is get from them a personal statement of how they think they should behave. And then we just keep going back and forth between how they are behaving and how they feel they should behave. And sometimes, partway through the group, some men will revise the policy a little bit. They'll say, "Yeah, well, you know, I didn't think about this, or I didn't think about that." But by and large, with some exceptions, and I will say there's some cultural exceptions, but by and large, most men do not feel that it's all right to beat their wives.
One of the points you make in your book is that you can't blame the alcohol for turning a man into an abuser.
That's right. I think, alcohol, what men do when they get drunk, and I made this point in the group, can vary from, you know, singing in the shower to giving their money away to, in some cases, becoming violent. And if the man becomes violent when he's drunk, then what that alcohol is doing is disinhibiting a learned action pattern that that man carries around with him, which happens to be violent. I think in the development of an abusive personality, there's a number of things we have to pay attention to. These men experience a lot of trauma symptoms, surprisingly enough, dysphoric states, sleep disturbances, depression, anxiety. One of the reasons why they drink is to blot out these bad feelings that they go through. That's also one of the reasons why they hit, because when they hit, they get rid of the anxiety, they get rid of all the pent-up tension, they act it out, they blow it out, they feel better after, although it's obviously had destructive consequences. So there's a kind of personality connection between both the substance abuse and the wife abuse. On top of that, if they're using alcohol, which has disinhibiting properties, then that makes it all the much easier for them to act out physically. So that is what I see as being the connection between the alcohol and the physical abuse, but it's not the man drinks and then there's a direct sort of billiard ball determinism connection between that and violence.
My guest is Donald Dutton. He directs the Assaultive Husband Program in Vancouver. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donald Dutton, author of the new book, The Batterer, A Psychological Profile. Are there any generalizations you can make about psychological problems that most abusers share?
Yeah, the main one, from our research, they've obviously got, you know, self-esteem. I mean, self-esteem problems, that one seems pretty self-evident. But to go beyond that, they have almost pathological jealousy, like pathological concerns about being abandoned, which I see as having attachment origins, that there was really shaky attachment that went on when they were growing up. And I think one of the reasons for that is that in many cases they had mothers who were themselves trying to deal with abusive husbands, and so the attachment was very intermittent. When you get that kind of positive-negative attachment, you develop someone who's really ambivalent about intimate relationships. They both strongly need them, and they're strongly afraid of them at the same time. They convert the fear part into anger, and so when they're in an intimate relationship that they need, they experience anger just as a consequence of attachment. They don't understand their anger in those terms, so they tend to blame it on things that their partner does and to make her the scapegoat for the things that they're feeling. But these men feel angry whenever they get close to a woman. They feel a sense of ongoing irritability out of closeness. So the jealousy is kind of a focused aspect of this fear of abandonment, because the man tends to think about it in sexual terms, and then that makes jealousy the main thing that he experiences. So he takes this sort of broader set of abandonment fears and narrows them down into feeling jealous.
I wonder if you've given any thought to how much of spousal abuse has to do with larger political, social, economic factors like, you know, misogyny in our culture, and how much of it is purely psychological, the upbringing that a man had, the environment he grew up in, and the impact that that's had on him.
I've given a lot of thought to that, because when I started doing this work, the sort of prevailing thought in those days was that it was all basically a sociopolitical explanation. It was basically misogyny, period. And what troubled me about that explanation is that there's so much heterogeneity amongst men that you can't really explain that heterogeneity. Since they're all growing up within the same culture, it raises a question of why men are so different. So I think, I mean, to answer your question, I think that the origins of abusiveness develop early on and are therefore psychological, and they develop in families where boys are shamed by their fathers, have insecure attachment with their mothers, and frequently have physically violent role models that they can pattern their behavior after as a way of acting out anger. And that, given that sort of psychological substratum, if you will, these men then go on to take on different aspects of the culture that really reinforce who they are. For example, a boy who's got a propensity to be abusive, who's, say, 16 or 17 years old, gets extremely jealous and dependent with his girlfriend, blows the relationship out of the water, blames her for it, finds another girlfriend, does the same thing again, blames her for it. Eventually, instead of blaming girlfriend A, B, C, he generalizes his blame to all women. And we find that abusive men have distinctively more negative attitudes towards women than do non-abusive men. Now, I think these men, in other words, shop around in the culture, the ambient culture, for negative beliefs about women, which they then use to justify their own abusiveness, so they get socialized differently.
So
the psychology and the sociology interact. Mm-hmm. The psychology is first, and it's primary, and it then shapes the way that the man adjusts to whatever the culture has to offer him.
Now, how much contact do you have with the wives or lovers of the abusive men in your groups?
Well, first of all, as soon as a man starts treatment, the first thing we do is go over and spend 2 or 3 hours talking to each one of the women about the entire relationship, about the man. We get her to fill in a number of descriptive scales about her husband. We spend a lot of time talking to her about what she would do if he became violent again. We go through a kind of re-victimization prevention program with her, going through a number of safety things that she can do, convincing her that it probably is a good idea to call 911, finding out if there's a locked room in the house where she could get to that has a telephone, if she's got support groups around, those kind of things. And then we basically have a kind of phone-in policy that she can call us, and we invite her to call us and keep us posted on how things are going. We'll usually see them maybe two more times, once during the time the man's in the group and once at the end of group, although there's exceptions to that. I mean, some women just get really involved. I mean, one woman in one of our groups drove the guy down to his treatment group every night, waited for him to complete it, and drove him back again at the end of the night. She really wanted to make sure that he was going to complete it. So again, there's individual variation, but the norm would be that we would see each one of them three times and keep phone contact between.
Do you often find that you get a completely different point of view about what's happening in the relationship when you talk with the woman than you heard from the man?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you get completely different points of view. And that's sort of, in some cases, I guess, a measure of the man's denial. I mean, we work on the assumption, not that everything the woman's going to tell us is gospel truth, but we think she's got less of a reason to gloss things over than he does. I mean, he's the one who's done something wrong, and he's the one who's being treated. And occasionally, I mean, you meet women, and it's just a completely different picture from what the man painted. And other times, there isn't really that much difference. It's the guy's giving you a pretty accurate picture of what things are like at home.
Can you give me an example of where it was a different picture?
Well, I met one man who, you know, kind of really depicted his wife as this kind of incompetent, couldn't look after the kids, just didn't have her own act together. And I met this woman who was with this guy, and she was so together that I thought this one would actually make a very good therapist. I mean, she had complete insight into herself, complete insight into him. She was a very sort of thorough person, both in her professional life, which he hadn't even told me about, that she had a job outside the home, and in terms of looking after the kids. She had just a real clear sort of philosophy for child rearing, etc. She was just a completely different person than what he'd described.
Did you take this information back to him and challenge him?
Well, yeah, you have to be careful in what you do with that. I mean, one obvious example is if the man says, well, I've stopped being violent, and you interview the woman and find out that's not true. I mean, the temptation is to run back into the next group and say, well, I talked to your wife 3 days ago, and she says you're still hitting her. Well, of course, if you do that, you can put the woman at risk again. But what you want to do is to find other ways. You know, usually you will interview the man in a little bit more depth at the end of that particular group, and the person who interviews him will not be the person that he knows interviewed his wife. So therapist A will have interviewed his wife. Therapist B will say to the man, so, you know, how are things going in your relationship these days? And you'll try and draw him out a little bit more. You use a kind of graduated system of techniques, but, I mean, if the man is not coming forward, we have gone to the point, in some cases, of actually whipping out the police report and reading the police report to him in group, saying, you know, you're telling us you don't have a problem with violence. Look at what it says here. Now, why are the police trying to lie to us? You know, why have they got anything to gain from lying to us? So it sounds to us like you're really not fessing up.
My guest is Donald Dutton. He directs the Assaultive Husband Program in Vancouver. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donald Dutton, author of the new book, The Batterer, A Psychological Profile. You were an expert witness in the O.J. Simpson trial for the prosecution.
Yes.
And this was in the pretrial?
Yes, it was a pretrial motion. Ironically enough, the defense, it was the defense that brought family violence into the Simpson case by filing a pretrial motion that claimed that they simply didn't want any reference to domestic violence used in court at all. They didn't want wife assault or wife battery or stalking or any of those terms used in court because they said they were highly prejudicial. They wanted the only term that the defense deemed acceptable was the term domestic discord. So they wanted to portray what went on between O.J. Simpson and Nicole Brown Simpson as a kind of mutual combat tiff that would occur quite typically between couples. The prosecution, of course, at that point had to file a counterbrief, and that's where I got called in. And what we did in the counterbrief was to point out that if you looked at studies of spousal homicides, now, if you looked at studies actually of all women being killed, you found half of them were spousal homicides. And when you looked at the spousal homicides, you found there'd always, 90% of the time, had been a recorded history of physical abuse that that couple had been experiencing from the man to the woman, that the man was described as being extremely jealous, that there was a history of separations and reconciliations for that couple, and that the woman typically was killed by what's described as overkill, that is, she was typically stabbed repeatedly with a knife. And so the argument that the prosecution wanted to make was that the signature characteristics of spousal homicides fitted this particular case, and therefore the domestic violence evidence was relevant.
Did you think that the patterns of domestic violence fit the O.J. Simpson case?
I did, yes, and still do.
How did you prepare for being an expert witness?
Well, the funny thing is I had no preparation at all because up until 10 minutes before I took the stand, we didn't know whether I was going to take the stand or not. So I basically was flying by the seat of my pants. Fortunately, I think everyone else in the courtroom was at that point, too, including Lee Bailey, who cross-examined me. I think if it had happened 4 or 5 months later with more preparation, it would have been a much tougher cross-examination. But basically, Bailey kept trying to get me to admit that someone who was the captain of the football team and therefore an upstanding citizen could not possibly be a wife batterer, which, of course, is completely opposite to what we know to be the truth.
What do you know to be the truth?
What we know to be the truth is that men who are wife batterers have two personalities, and the private one is completely distinct from the public one. And I don't think there's any case that made this more salient than the O.J. Simpson case because, I mean, it's not in dispute that there was violence that took place between him and Nicole Brown Simpson, and I'm not talking about whether he killed her or not. I'm talking about the battering incidents in 1989, you know, and the 911 call in 1993. When people heard that 911 call and heard him sort of ranting in the background, it was really startling for a lot of people who had this sort of smiling image of O.J., you know, as the front man for a variety of sponsorships. And then hearing the discrepancy between the two was shocking. But that really is what abusive personalities are about.
You know, abusive men fool the women in their lives? You know, when they go through the period of apology and contrition, do they fool the therapist too? Do you get fooled?
I don't think so. I mean, they don't fool us for we're pretty cynical. And we've seen most of the excuses and, you know, most of the con jobs. I've been doing therapy with battering men since 1979. So it's pretty rare for us to get fooled. You know, and basically, I think one of the reasons for that is that whatever the man says is fine, we're going to work with him in group, but we're really looking for him to walk the walk rather than just talk the talk. And until we've got evidence from his wife that he's doing that, and he stopped being abusive, and this is fairly consistent, then I don't think we get fooled. I mean, I think in the early days we got fooled a few times, but not so much anymore.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Donald Dutton directs the Assaultive Husbands Program in Vancouver and is a psychology professor at the University of British Columbia. He's the author of the book The Batterer, A Psychological Profile. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Alan Tu, with Nancy Updike and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Our intern is Sapora Lubar. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.